The MadTech Podcast, news of the week in ad tech and marketing tech, brought to you by ExchangeWire. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of the ExchangeWire MadTech Podcast. I'm Mariam, editorial lead here at ExchangeWire, and we actually have a team podcast today, which is always very exciting. So I'm delighted to be introducing, firstly, our COO, Lindsay Rountree. Lindsay, fantastic to have you here.
Great to be here. I feel like I haven't done one of these for ages, so it's good to be back.
I know. Me and John were just talking about that, actually. Also joining us for today's episode is John Still, who is head of content here at ExchangeWire. John, great to have you.
Lovely to be back. Thank you very much, Mariam. Always a pleasure.
So we've got a lot of interesting stories on the slate today. And the first one, I think, will possibly rile some people up. So I'm just going to dive straight into it. And that is that the BBC plan to commercialize podcasts, and this could potentially be very catastrophic. This news comes from the Media Leader. So the BBC is considering plans to include ads in selected BBC podcasts when they are hosted in the UK on commercial sites. This obviously includes Apple and Spotify. So under the plan, the activity could be carried out by the BBC Studios, which works to commercialize BBC commissioned TV and audio content, such as through broadcaster UK TV, sales of audiobooks, and ads on BBC commissioned podcasts outside the UK. So this could obviously ruffle a few feathers. Lindsay, I'm going to go to you first here. How does the BBC's plan to include ads in selected podcasts align with its public service broadcasting mandate?
It's a funny one. It's such a As you said, it's a topic that really rolls people up whenever anyone mentions the BBC. And for those that aren't aware, obviously many countries have public service broadcaster. In the BBC in the UK, we pay an annual license fee to access all that content. I know in the US, like PBS and stuff, it's like federally funded and through donations. But we actually have to pay an annual license fee of about £150 or something a year, to access BBC content. So, and the part of that is that we don't get ads served to us. So it immediately annoys people when they hear that they could be served ads when they already pay a license fee. Everybody in this country seems to hate the license fee. I feel like it's going to be a bit of a messy one. I mean, on the one hand, I get where they're coming from. Like, if you're going to be putting content out on non-owned and operated platforms like Spotify and, you know, Apple Podcasts, then you should be able to kind of try and commercialize it anywhere you want if people access that the same content, which they can. It isn't like that content will only be available with advertising. You can actually access that content without ads on BBC Sounds, their audio app. So it isn't like you will only be served ads when listening to that content. So there's ways around it. And they already do things like trying to get people to use BBC Sounds over and above going to places like Spotify and Apple Podcasts for their content by giving you early access to different episodes. So it's a bit like what like Wondery do as a subscriber. They do as a public service broadcaster to get you to enjoy things, you know, ad free, without asking you for money, because obviously we already pay the money in the license fee. We are technically subscribing for the content already. But I feel like what's interesting to me is the notion around kind of what the mandate of public service broadcasting is, and it's different in every single country. I was looking into this because I've just mentioned PBS, obviously in the US, they don't have ads, but they do have things like sponsor messages from corporate partners. There are some public service broadcasters I think ABC in Australia, and to a degree ARD and ZDF, and ARD and ZDF in Germany are specifically relevant to the UK because people again pay a license fee that I think is actually more expensive than what it is in the UK, and they do get a light, albeit light, but they do get an ad load on there when they're watching content on ARD and ZDF. So, you know, you could argue that we are fortunate that we've never had to experience any ads from BBC content. But I think that what a lot of your average UK consumer won't understand or maybe even heard of is BBC Studios. And they won't understand what BBC Studios is. They won't realise maybe that a lot of the content that they're watching on BBC in the UK, two examples I can think of like Fleabag and Killing Eve, were actually created and funded by BBC Studios, which is the BBC's commercial arm, and that also helped to commercialize them internationally, and they became huge hits in like the US and other markets as well. And without BBC Studios, we probably wouldn't get the same cachet for some of our content that we're getting alongside that. But also if people realized what BBC Studios is and just how much revenue BBC Studios makes, it would make them even more angry because I think in the last fiscal year, they made $2 billion in revenue, £2 billion in revenue from their commercial arm, from things like funding and syndicating UK content in internationally, funding international content, and this is audio and video content, and they, you know, that it's doing very, very well. But as a business, the BBC is generally underfunded. They tend to moan constantly that, you know, they don't have enough money, and that's why they have to keep increasing the license fee. So just the mention of ads without the UK average UK consumer understanding just how much money BBC Studios rakes in. I'm not saying their profit's that strong, because obviously content is expensive and platforms are expensive and commercial, like international commercialization of broadcasted content is expensive, but their revenue is high, and your average person on the street would be fuming if they knew that they were bringing in £2 billion and were suggesting serving ads to your average UK listener who wants to listen to a random podcast about, I don't know, chickens or The Archers, although The Archers actually probably wouldn't get ad funded initially, but they would be really, really angry about it, and I think it would cause a lot of controversy. But I'm not completely against it. I get where they're coming from, and I think that maybe the mandate of what public service broadcasting looks like in this country needs to be updated as consumption is updated.
Yeah, that's an interesting point that you make, because actually, speaking of license fees, they're increasing their license fee next month. So,
you're right. I forgot about that. That's the thing. I don't even know what I pay. I pay this every year, and you know, equating it to like a subscription fee, because that actually kind of is what it is, and I pay subscription fees for every bloody other channel that exists, but I know what I pay for those, but I have no clue what I pay for the license fee. It just comes out of my account every year, and that's the end of it.
I think many people probably are in the same boat as you, Lindsay, in that regard. And I also think I read something about this, and it said it was kind of like this is obviously taking quite like a negative view of it, but they're kind of saying that the audacity of the BBC, because if it means that they're using advertisers to sort of fund their content, then that could open up a can of worms that they're not willing to sort of discuss at the moment, you know? But John, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that this will cause a problem for the fact that they're a public service broadcasting service?
I don't know. It's like Lindsay's gone through a lot of points there that I agree with all of, really. The trick is here that there's a real cake and eat it attitude towards the BBC, I feel, in the country. You know, we love this. This is a jewel in our cultural crown that, you know, it's around the world. We're renowned for the BBC, and people don't want to pay for it. And it's coming under fire from, you know, the wealth of conservative governments we've had over the last 14 years have cut the license fee. It's not meeting the rise in inflation. Nadine Dorries, I believe, said it was going to be cut totally by 2027. And there's somewhere along the line, something has to give there if we want to keep getting the quality content that we do from the BBC. You know, like you've both said, license fee goes out. I use the BBC plenty. I'm a big advocate for what the BBC does. I think the quality is incredible. Lindsay, the point about BBC Studios is very well made. They are not wanting for cash in what they can put together and sell around the world through BBC Studios. I don't have a problem personally with, you know, if I wanted to listen to a podcast like I've been loving Believe in Magic, which came out last year, which was wonderful, really high quality documentary stuff. If I want to listen to it on Spotify, I would expect to hear ads because it's on Spotify, which is an ad funded platform. So I don't have a problem with them doing it, but I can see the other side of the discussion, which is, you know, the industry looking and saying, this is publicly funded. Why are you dipping into our ad space? This is increased competition. We are now seeing an incredibly high quality commissioned product that could be taking money away when it's already been well funded by the public, and it is going to be competing for ad money. It's going to come with its own price tag, and I'm all for it. I think it's fine. I think they need to make the shortfall up if we want to keep getting high quality stuff. But yeah, I can see that it will ruffle feathers indeed.
So Lindsay, you know, obviously this is big news. The BBC is a big provider. So how do you think ads and BBC podcasts on commercial platforms will potentially impact competition, if at all?
I don't think, when you say competition, do you mean will listeners go somewhere else?
Right, yes.
because I think that it might cause listeners to go to the BBC Sounds app, which is no bad thing for BBC. Like they, like, you know, if they can't get the money from the ads, they're happy to get the data from the list, from the listenership, which, you know, they don't know the level of data they would get from their own O&O platform versus Spotify or Apple Podcasts will be significantly more. They can then do with that what they will, monetize whatever else. So that will be very, very valuable to them. Will it cause people to stop listening to podcasts? I don't think so, because if the content's good enough, they will still listen to it. And the BBC churn out some really, you know, John, you mentioned Believe in Magic, excellent podcast, really, really interesting. There's some really good documentary style podcasts on the BBC that are worth listening to, and having to hear an ad wouldn't stop me. I mean, I personally listen to BBC Sounds, so it doesn't make a difference to me anyway. But if I were so staunchly devoted to Spotify or Apple Podcasts and wouldn't listen to anything else, then I'd be fine with it, because I listen to tons of other podcasts that all serve me ads as well, even on platforms that I pay for. So I'm kind of used to it. I'm used to paying for things and getting ads at the same time. That's kind of what a lot of other platforms are getting us quite used to that at the moment. I know the BBC is publicly funded, funded by us. Everything else is funded by us too. Like Netflix is being funded by me as much as BBC is. So, and I, you know, I'll be getting ads on that at some point, I'm sure. Amazon are doing the same thing. Pick a platform, any platform. I know that other platforms are going down the opposite route, like, you know, as in the BVOD platforms like ITV, which actually specifically don't want to be called a BVOD platform, because it's a streaming platform, not a BVOD platform. But let's, for argument's sake, say it's a BVOD platform in the fact that it's a public broadcaster in the UK. And Channel 4 as well, they're going down the if you pay, you will not see ads. And the BBC are kind of doing, you know, almost flipping the script on that one, which will annoy people more. But I don't necessarily think that the average, certainly young consumer, it's the people in their 60s and 70s that will be really wild by it. But the average young consumer, I think, understands the value exchange and will not really bat an eyelid at it.
Mm. John, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think this will somehow impact competition?
No, I just, yeah, totally agree with what Lindsay just said. Like, I expect, if I'm going to listen to a podcast on Spotify, I expect that I will hear an ad with it. If I am watching a show on Netflix and I've not chosen to pay for the ad-free tier, I expect to see an ad on whatever content, and that can be BBC Studios anyway. It's, yeah, the value exchange, it will be understood by younger generations and users now, I think, but it will rile. And I'm sure, you know, more fodder for the culture war cannon going forward. If the BBC starts to put ads in, you know, I'll be out there waving my red and purple St. George's flag, supporting the BBC while the right-wing media go mental about it. Like I say, personally, no problem with it, but I can see the pros and cons and how the argument might play out.
Definitely a polarizing one. It'll be interesting to see how this one plays out. I just want to move us on to our next story here, which comes from TechCrunch, and that is Apple, Google, and Meta face their first formal investigation under the EU's DMA. So some huge news here. So Meta, Apple, and Alphabet, which owns Google, obviously, are being looked into for potential breaches of the EU's Digital Marketing Act introduced in 2022. If they are found to have broken the rules, the firms can face huge fines of up to 10% of their annual turnover. So Lindsay, obviously huge, huge news here. We're just seeing this play out in real time. Do you think this will actually be a deterrent for big tech, or will they find yet another loophole?
I think yes and yes to both of those things. I think it will deter them from doing the thing they're currently doing. And yes, they will find a loophole to deter them from what they're currently doing, to allow them to continue what they're doing, but in a way that keeps DMA happy. And that is what they have done since the dawn of existence. Right. And what they will continue to do. And they might along the way get a 10% or 20% if they're repeat offenders. They might along the way be fined. They will contest it. They have these fines built into their P&L. So they'll be expecting, I mean, 10% is whopping, of course, but they will, you know, they're not stupid. They've got everybody they need on their side to be able to make sure that they can come out of this not unscathed. These things always do scathe them in some way, and kind of, and they do help to kind of gradually kind of like knock a brick out of them and make them a little bit weaker. But if you imagine, like, you know, Google is like 10 million bricks and the DMA comes and knocks one brick out of them, there's still 9,999,000 other bricks that can keep them up and keep them upright and supported. That's what it feels like to me. I think that the DMA, you know, have gone after, looking at kind of Apple and Google specifically, they've gone after their app stores, and they've gone after them being gatekeepers and kind of not allowing people to kind of to be able to go to different areas outside the app stores, or kind of like telling them that oh, you are leaving the safety of the Apple environment by going, oh, God knows, somewhere else, how scary for you, kind of causing, again, your average consumer to go, oh, no, that's terrifying, I must stay within the Apple ecosystem, and sort of blocking people from being able to exit the ecosystem. Only the beginning of, I think, this month, it was announced that they had reversed on kind of the whole Epic Games saga, when it, you know, Epic Games wanted to make their own app store so they could charge what they liked, because they were being completely, done over by Apple and their ridiculous app store fees, as every app developer that has apps on the Apple store will tell you. And because of DMA cutting in and kind of, you know, with the whole gatekeeper argument again, they had to renege on that, and they have now allowed Epic Games to, well, Epic Games will be allowed to create their own kind of app store version to have people be able to access those apps outside of the Apple ecosystem, which is a really big thing, because it was a massive piece of news at the time. Lots of legal wranglings that kind of went on and on throughout this, you know, with both parties suing each other. And now the DMA have been able to step in and actually kind of cause a reversal. So I think it shows the power the DMA could have in these arguments. But I think that they could go further than the App Store for both Apple. I mean, for Meta, it's you have to pay or you're going to get targeted to shit, basically. And for Apple and Google, it's around steering people in a certain direction within their app stores. You could argue that of any Google property, there's gatekeeping involved. With any Apple property, even probably worse, there is gatekeeping involved, because Apple are desperate to keep you in their own ecosystem. Google the same, maybe not quite as much, but, you know, both of them are gatekeeping in every single possible avenue. You know, think of YouTube, think of Apple TV. There's probably gatekeeping in every single area. And the DMA, I think, need to and could go further than what they have done. But having said that, this is a really good and interesting starting point, and it will make, well, like I said at the beginning, I think it will just make all those companies try and find a way of being able to deter them from doing what they're currently doing, but make them find a way of being able to still do it through a loophole that will circumvent the whole gatekeeper terminology, but still effectively make them gatekeepers. I don't really know how that will look or how that will work, but they're pretty seasoned in this now.
Right. And, you know, we've said this a few times on the podcast, like, it seems to be the decade of big tech litigation. And maybe it's the pessimist in me, but is anything actually being done? Are there actual solid changes coming through? John, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think this will be a deterrent for big tech?
I hope this one has teeth. I'm not sure how many times we've been on the podcast talking about, you know, legislation that just turns into saber rattling and never comes of anything because, you know, some wording is changed or some promises are made. This one feels different. I think the scope of it and the speed at which it's going to be, it seems to have been enacted, makes me feel like that this might actually have to cause some change in the industry. And they will find loopholes, like Lindsay said, they always do. All of us here are too jaded to think that they wouldn't. But I can honestly see that there is not just will, but like solid reasoning behind this to make this really stick. I think the people who are in charge of making this happen have got to the same jaded point we have and have decided, no, this time, like, we really have to do something that benefits the industry for the sake of competition, because it's gone too far. And like Lindsay says, there needs to be more done. But I'm choosing to reverse my normal position on any kind of legislation and be positive and think that, yes, this will cause some change. I think the meat of the discussion lies in what that change looks like. And how, you know, I think there's a couple of schools of thought that are quite interesting. Shiv Gupta, AirGups on Twitter, is a good follow. I'd recommend it. But he said, surely big tech companies will be better served spinning off parts of their businesses rather than changing to appease regulators, which is something that's been, you know, Kieran O'Kane of Exchangewire has been saying a while as well, like, companies are going to have to start selling parts of their businesses. We also spoke to Lazar Radic of ICLE about the legal side of it, and he was, you know, saying that basically whatever they have to do to appease DMA, they're going to have to do everywhere else, as you've got two different business models around the globe. So I think, yeah, it's adapting to get around the rules, finding the loopholes, but it'll be very, very interesting to see if any aspects of these giants are divested for me.
Right. And obviously, I think it's important to remember that this is the EU's DMA. So we're talking about a specific region here. But my next question, I'll go to you, Lindsay, here first. Do you think, and you can, we've sort of touched on this in your last answer, but what are the potential sort of future implications of this for big tech? Do you think, you know, there will be some things that they change going forward?
I definitely do. And it, I guess it ties in with what John was saying, that the lawyer that you guys spoke to came up with and said, you know, this won't just be a thing that affects Europe. Whatever they have to do in Europe, they have to do everywhere. You know, we've seen that happen. You know, Apple have been targeted quite heavily by the EU over a number of different things, even the charging cables they use. You know, if they do that one place, they can't just kind of devote that to kind of a few countries. They've got to do it everywhere, and it's a pain in the backside for them. They'd rather not do it. But if there's enough clout behind organizations like the DMA that kind of make them do it, it will cause changes. I think from what we see living in it, the changes don't seem very big. We might look back in 10 years and go, actually, that was a big thing that happened. That was a huge change. And it's actually kind of paved the way for where we are now. And it's, again, it's taking it's knocking out one brick at a time. Like, it doesn't feel like a big impact, but maybe it is a bigger impact than we actually see. And maybe we'll see that these companies do start looking quite different or start operating quite differently. I mean, yeah, as you said, John, we've been talking about divestment for a long time. Like, it needs to happen. And certainly the DOJ are, that's what they're pushing for in the US. They are really pushing to break up big tech. DMA is looking to regulate big tech, and I think that the two kind of working in tandem will cause something to happen. It's just, will they be broken up? Will they be regulated? Ultimately, the regulators need to get ahead of big tech, and that I think is where the downfall is. We're never ahead of them, we're always behind them, because they tend to be able to build things quicker than anyone realizes they built it. And then, because there isn't the right skills and expertise in these areas to be able to kind of go, oh, that's a bit dodgy, we should probably look into that. It takes them to be told 2 years later that what's being done is not a good thing, and they go, okay, we'll look into that in another 5 years' time. And that is the problem. And then it'll take another 12 months for a conclusion to come for this. And then, of course, Google, Apple and Meta will try an appeal decision, and that will then probably put it on pause for another year. And then it'll probably get either repealed or appealed again, and it goes on and on and on. So changes are incremental. I think they are happening. If we look back to 10 years, you know, things like GDPR coming in, that was a huge, huge change. Like, these companies have had to change the way they operate. Now, in a lot of cases, they've just made a lot of loopholes and haven't necessarily done things that are kind of GDPR compliant, but there have been changes made. So I do think we will see it, but it'll just be really, really bloody slow, because this process is so slow.
It's like a hangover effect, really. John, what are your thoughts on that? Are there any sort of future implications for this for big tech? Do you foresee any?
Yeah, I mean, to what Lindsay said, it's not just shutting the door after the horse has bolted. It's they're shutting the door while the horse keeps its hoof in the door and just says no repeatedly to the to the regulation. That's what we've seen for years, until we can actually get ahead of the regulation. I'm hopeful that this will cause some action. I hope it's beneficial for the consumer as well as just for competition. I hope, you know, that's always a hope with this legislation, that everyone benefits ultimately. We'll keep an eye out, and we'll be covering it very closely this year, because it is big news. Regardless of how cynical we might be about it, it's unprecedented, the level of pressure that they're going to come under from this, and very keen to see what they make stick this time.
Yeah, we actually have a non-sponsored piece coming out on this, so keep your eyes peeled for that one. But staying on thread with big tech, but in a different capacity, I want to move us on to our last story. And that comes from Disney Press, and that is that Disney simplifies their streaming inventory access for advertisers. So Disney has created a direct path to advertiser demand with two of the most scaled media buying platforms in the marketplace. This is, of course, Google's Display and Video 360 and The Trade Desk. So through the launch of DRAX Direct, Disney has delivered a heightened level of automation to marketers by unifying access to streaming inventory across Hulu and Disney Plus for advertisers of all sizes. So Lindsay, what are your views on this? Do you think that, in what ways will this influence the landscape of advertising and media buying strategies?
I feel like it's a little bit like bye-bye Magnite. And I know that Disney has said they're still like, it's to the detriment of the SSPs, basically. And that's fine. That's what Disney's concerned. Disney don't need to worry about that. It's not their job to keep the SSPs in business. And they have said they'll still be, a lot for the SSPs to do in terms of aggregating smaller advertiser demand, and they want to be able to bring in, allow smaller advertisers access to the to the Disney platform, to the Drax. By the way, I hate the name Drax. I really DR it. I look at it, I see the word draconian, and I just think of like old. It just feels ancient to me. I don't like it. Anyway, that aside, my own personal misgivings on the name aside, it obviously gives a lot of power to Google. And the trade desk, it gives power to Google on the buy side, but it takes away power on the everywhere else, basically, because Disney are building their own direct supply path to Google and the trade desk. That is in itself very, very interesting, and it's, you know, the trade desk's kind of, it's tied in with the trade desk big announcement that OpenPath is going down into CTV, so it's going to be fascinating from that perspective. But it just feels like another walled garden in a really, really already complex and walled garden-y CTV landscape. Here comes another one. So I'll be interested to see how it plays out. And I'd be interested to see, like Disney have said, you know, we're still going to be working with the SSPs and Magnite specifically, I think were called out to aggregate smaller business, smaller direct demand. But I feel like, you know, going back to talking about gatekeepers, I feel like you might still do that. But ultimately, how easy will it be for those smaller advertisers to access Disney inventory and access Disney supply when you've got Disney working directly for the majority of its content, its inventory, with the likes of Google of a trade desk? That's what I just straight away read it and I thought, oh, well, that's the end of the SSPs on this, for this part of the ecosystem then, because what can they do? If Disney are doing it, others will do it. Kind of what does the future of CTV look like on the supply side? Basically, it does raise a few interesting questions.
Right. It's interesting that you bring up the walled garden aspect of it, because obviously in a different thread, we're talking about different things here. But what I immediately thought of is what with Privacy Sandbox, what Google's trying to do. Are they just trying to create another, you know, walled garden for themselves? Just not to shit on big tech, but to kind of shit on big tech. It's kind of like the same vein of thinking here. John, what are your views on that? Do you think that, you know, how will this influence the landscape of advertising and media buying strategies?
Yeah, it's like the name that made me laugh. I thought it was named after a Marvel / Disney character Drax.
It does. Drax. Is there a character called Drax?
In Guardians of, like, nerd talk, in Guardians of the Galaxy, there is a character called Drax the Destroyer, which I thought was ironic because Drax is the destroyer of the SSP.
There's no irony in this. There's no coincidences. 100%.
Yeah. Drax the Destroyer. I had the same thoughts of Lindsay. It was the SSP, you know, it's what someone think of the SSPs. There was this quote came out from Disney saying SSPs aren't going anywhere. Drax is simply a much more transparent way for our buyers to connect to Disney. So, oh no, SSPs are cool. We just have found a better way around this. We're going to do for ourselves. Thanks, guys. Yeah, I think it's, yeah, Disney's first step. I mean, they've got like the wealth of IP that Disney has and stuff on their platform.
It's unbelievable.
It's a natural, I think, a natural move to create this walled garden to try and sell it themselves. It's, for them, a huge move. Obviously, DV360 and Trade Desk, it's hugely beneficial to it as well. But yeah, same. I can only echo Lindsay's thoughts. My first thought was, okay. SSPs are going to be moved out of this equation quite quickly.
Lindsay, what are your thoughts on the fact that this might reflect any broader trends? I mean, we kind of touched on it in a different vein with the last story, but what are your thoughts on that?
I don't know. And this is obviously like this, while this is a very US focused story in terms of where Disney has huge scale, it's also huge because it's Disney Plus. I think it's Hulu as well. It affects kind of everything globally, but also, you know, there's in India, for example, there is Disney Hotstar. So it'll affect inventory being bought on Hotstar too, which is going to be huge to the Indian market in terms of access to supply in that market. Because Hotstar is absolutely a huge streaming platform in India. And I think that there's going to be more walled gardens. That there absolutely are, that are going to first of all hope that, you know, it's certainly a way of dampening down Google's power. The one space that Google really can't gain traction is, weirdly, despite YouTube, CTV. YouTube has been argued long, like for a long time, kind of what is YouTube? Is YouTube CTV? Is it video? Like, where does it sit in the ecosystem? Because YouTube is just YouTube. And a lot of people say they spend X million dollars a year on CTV. They actually mean YouTube. They actually mean all the money is going into Google. So things like this will make it more difficult for Google to get traction in this market if they're unable to access supply through their own means. They have to go through a walled garden like Disney being built. So that, for me, makes it interesting. There'll be more of this, because there's the fragmentation yet comparative consolidation of CTV in the US market specifically is fascinating and complicated. And I think that they will all, if Disney do this with Drax Direct, it'll happen elsewhere. I'm just intrigued as to kind of what it will mean for buyers. Will it make it will it make it easier for buyers, or make it more complicated for buyers? Buyers want ease. So actually Disney have been very smart by going directly through the Trade Desk and Google. Because if you can buy it through Google, you can buy it through Trade Desk, it means it will actually happen. If you have to go somewhere else to try and buy it, they won't bother. So I think it will make it interesting from that perspective. But I find the CTV market so messy anyway. I really do. And of course, when we talk about this a lot, like a lot of what happens in the US just doesn't impact other markets, because the CTV landscape is so different from region to region, because the platforms, the setup, the consumption, the trends are just also different from market to market, let alone region to region. The languages. But Disney obviously is a global brand, a global platform. I think that people will stop and look at this and go, well, we could probably do something similar, and we'll want to, because who wouldn't want to basically aggregate their own supply and allow buyers to target it, to access it directly? It makes a lot of sense for a lot of people, and we see it all the time in normal digital publishing. Like we see that kind of people wanting to kind of be able to aggregate and to have direct access to buyers. It's a great way of going about things, not to disintermediate the SSPs, but to just be able to have control over your own supply. Who wouldn't want that?
It makes sense. John, what are your thoughts on that? Do you think that this reflects any broader trends? Are we witnessing sort of like the decade of, you know, walled gardens?
Yeah, I just again agree with, can only echo what Lindsay said there, really. I agree with everything. It's interesting. As this, you know, this isn't necessarily a canary in the coal mine move, because it's not unique, but it's a big one, and will certainly set trends for the other streaming platforms. The US market's so much different, but we'll see what happens over here as well. We talk a lot, and we're hearing a lot in the industry at the moment about that, looking to buy quality, looking to buy against the big names, to be involved with the big publishers. And yeah, it's 100% makes sense that Disney have this wealth of IP from Disney, Pixar, Star Wars, Marvel across their platforms. Star, like Lindsay said, Hotstar globally as well. Like, you know, they realize that they have what advertisers want, and it's a first, you know, it's a step towards really harnessing that. They've talked about not disintermediating SSPs, because they have advertisers of all sizes who will be looking to gain a foothold in different ways. And this is just one way into their system. They'll still be working with Magnite. They don't want to take food off their table. But ultimately it will. Anyway, that was my thought for that anyway.
So I think that is a good punctuation point for today's episode, as unfortunately we've run out of time. But John, thank you so much for joining me on today's episode.
No, pleasure. Thank you very much.
Lindsay, a pleasure as always.
Likewise. Thank you so much.
And that was it for this week's MadTech podcast episode.